The session will start with Michael Levin, who's going to talk about protected edge modes without symmetry, and then Brian Siegel.
Thank you. Okay, thanks. Thanks for the opportunity to talk here. As the title of my talk suggests, what I'm going to be discussing today is the physics of protected edge modes. But before I do that, I first need to tell you, what do I mean by protected edge mode? So basic setup that I have in mind is the following. Imagine that we have some kind of two-dimensional quantum many-body system. This quantum many-body system could be built out of electrons. It could be built out of spins. It could be built out of bosons hopping on a lattice. We can be very general at this stage. Now, some two-dimensional quantum many-body systems have an interesting property. If you diagonalize the system deep within the bulk, you find that there's a finite energy gap separating excited states from the ground state. The system has an energy gap in the bulk. On the other hand, if you repeat this and you look at the energy spectrum near the boundary or the interface with the vacuum, you find that there are arbitrarily low energy excited states. In other words, there are gapless excitations near the boundary, edge excitations or edge modes present near the boundary. Now, the existence of gapless edge modes isn't in itself maybe that interesting. So many, even boring insulators, boring atomic insulators, can have gapless edge modes depending on exactly how they're cleaved and other details about the edge. But what is interesting is that some quantum many-body systems have these edge modes are extremely robust. Okay, they cannot be gapped out no matter what interactions are introduced near the edge, and they can't be localized no matter what disorder is present. They're somehow protected by the structure of the bulk phase. Now, I want to emphasize that this notion of protection is much stronger than merely the notion of a perturbative stability. So these modes that are present in these systems that I have in mind, not only are they stable against small interactions or weak disorder, you can have arbitrarily strong interactions near the boundary, much larger than the gap. You have arbitrarily strong disorder, and the modes still have to persist. So, you know, this is a very interesting phenomenon, and, you know, a natural question, an important question, is to try to figure out for what systems, which quantum many-body systems have these protected edge modes, and also what are the physical mechanisms that's responsible for this sort of unusual stability. And, you know, that's the question that I'm going to basically be discussing in this talk. I'm going to focus on addressing that question in sort of a particularly simple case, which is the case of, I'm going to try to understand protected edge modes in quantum many-body systems without any symmetry. Okay, but before I go there and sort of get to that question, I first want to give you two illustrative examples of systems with protected edge modes that will help motivate the questions which I'm going to ask and try to address. So historically, the first example of a system with protected edge modes was the integer quantum Hall states. The basic idea here is very simple. Imagine we have some kind of two-dimensional electron gas that's moving in the presence of a perpendicular uniform magnetic field. Now, for our purposes, we can treat these electrons as non-interacting because the physics that we are interested in doesn't depend strongly on interactions. Now, of course, integer quantum Hall states correspond to the case where you have just the right number of electrons to fill up some integer number of Landau levels, some, let's say, k Landau levels. That would be a nu equals k integer quantum Hall state. Now, if you're in that situation and you diagonalize the system in the bulk, of course you're going to find an energy gap given by the cyclotron frequency. On the other hand, if you instead consider a finite geometry with a boundary and you diagonalize the system there, what do you find? Well, you find that there are, while it's gapped in the bulk, you find that there are gapless excitations localized near the edge, edge excitations or edge modes. And these edge modes are chiral. They only propagate in one direction. And you find that depending on how many Landau levels you fill up, depending on the filling factor, that's the number of edge modes that you'll find. So a nu equals 1 state has one edge mode, a nu equals 2 state has two chiral edge modes, and so on. OK, so that's all well and good. But the question that I want to ask is, or that we should think about, is why are these edge modes protected in this case? So in this case, you can kind of understand the protection intuitively, a very intuitive level, as coming from the chirality of the modes. So imagine that if you imagine putting some kind of obstacle or disorder at the boundary, because the modes are chiral, they have basically no option except to go around your obstacle. They can't be scattered backwards. And because of that, because they can only go around whatever impurities or other disorder you put on the edge, you can kind of imagine that this mode is going to be extremely stable. Now, actually, this phenomenon of protected edge modes coming from chirality is an example of there's a more general statement one can make, which is the following. It turns out that given any system which has a different number of right and left moving edge modes, where nr minus nl is different from zero, any system like that is guaranteed to have some kind of protected edge mode. So there are different ways of understanding this statement. At a very intuitive level, one can understand it as follows. If you imagine, you can convince yourself that if you add, say, some kinds of interactions or you introduce impurities at the edge, those might introduce backscattering, scattering right-moving electrons into left-moving electrons. And that backscattering can indeed gap out edge modes. But you can convince yourself that any such backscattering terms, they gap out edge modes, but they always gap out a pair of right and left moving modes. They always gap out one, they always come in pairs. So if there's an imbalance between the number of right and left moving modes, there always has to be at least one mode left over. So that's one way of understanding this existence of a protected edge modes. Another, perhaps deeper way to understand it is to recognize that this difference, nr minus nl, is proportional to something called the thermal hall conductance. And the thermal hall conductance is very much analogous to the more familiar electric hall conductance. Now, just as the electric hall conductance tells you the electric current that flows in response to a perpendicular voltage or chemical potential gradient, the thermal hall conductance tells you that the energy or heat current that flows in response to a perpendicular temperature gradient. And just like the electric hall conductance, one can prove results about stability of edge modes given a non-zero value of the thermal hall conductance. So in particular, just as a non-zero value of the electric hall conductance guarantees the existence of a protected edge mode as long as charge conservation is not broken, you can show that a non-zero value of the thermal hall conductance guarantees an existence of a protected edge mode as long as energy conservation is not broken. So it's a consequence at some very deep level of energy conservation. And of course, all the systems I'm going to be talking about are energy conserving. So this is a very a robust phenomenon.
So with the argument you gave, it feels like the only thing that matters is whether it's even or odd.
No. I went too quickly. The statement is that when you're talking about the backscattering argument. The backscattering argument gaps out one right-moving mode and one left-moving mode. A right-moving mode always comes with a left-moving mode. So it doesn't change this difference. In other words, it doesn't change the thermal hall conductance. That's a universal quantity.
Well, you could have right moving modes that didn't come in left moving mode, then it wouldn't gap.
I'm sorry?
You could have opposite modes that don't gap.
That's right. But I'm asking the question of, can we make some strong statements about it being impossible to gap? Okay, so this is one example of protected edge modes, and it comes from this imbalance between the number of left and right moving modes, or equivalently a non-zero thermal hall conductance. So let me give you another example of protected edge modes that illustrates a different kind of physics. So this example is given by the two-dimensional topological insulators, or also called quantum spin Hall states. So I don't want to go into detail about topological insulators because you've probably heard about them ad nauseum, but I just remind you very quickly what they are. So two-dimensional topological insulators, these are band insulators. They're time reversal invariant band insulators, and they're qualitatively different from conventional insulators. They belong to a different universality class. And how are they different? Well, physically, the main difference is that topological insulators have robust edge modes, protected edge modes at their boundary with the vacuum, whereas conventional insulators do not. And I've underlined time reversal invariant here because, as I'm going to discuss shortly, we'll see time reversal invariance plays a very key role in this physics. Okay, so enough about topological insulators. What about their edge? That's what we're here to discuss. So what does the edge of a topological insulator look like? Well, it looks at least the simplest model for its edge. It's just basically like two copies of an integer quantum Hall edge. So you have spin-up electrons, one right-moving mode made up of spin-up electrons, and one left-moving mode made up of spin-down electrons. And you convince yourself that this kind of edge is actually time reversal invariant. Okay, so now the question is, what about in this case? Why is the topological insulator edge protected? Well, you might be worried, because if you remember what I said a few minutes ago is that in general, when you have left and right moving modes, you may expect that you can gap them out by some kind of backscattering, right? The only reason the integer quantum Hall edge was protected was because there was an imbalance between the number of left and right moving modes. And here, there's no such imbalance. So you may be worried that the edge can be gapped out. And indeed, the edge can be gapped out. The rules of the game here are a little bit different. A topological insulator edge can be gapped out by general perturbations. The statement is that the topological insulator edge can't be gapped out as long as certain symmetries are preserved, in particular, time reversal symmetry and charge conservation symmetry. The rules of the game are it's protected as long as those symmetries are not broken. So it's kind of a weaker form of edge protection. So how does it work? So I just to give you a cartoon picture for how it works, you can think about the following picture, which is you can ask yourself, okay, what are the different ways I could gap out this edge? And we'll see that each way that you try to gap out the edge is basically prohibited by the various symmetries that we're going to impose on the problem. So the simplest way of gapping out the edge is to add a backscattering term that scatters a right moving spin up electron into a left moving spin down electron. So that would be some term like this. And indeed, if you add such a term, it will gap out the edge of a topological insulator. It's basically a Zeeman field in the x direction. However, you can easily convince yourself that this term is odd under time reversal symmetry. So it's prohibited as long as we require our system to be time reversal symmetric, as long as we impose that symmetry. There's another way you could also gap out the edge, which is you could imagine adding a term a pairing term, which backscatters a right moving spin up electron into a left moving spin down hole. Again, you can see that this term will in fact gap out the edge, but this term again is prohibited by the various symmetries of the problem, in particular it's prohibited by charge conservation symmetry. Okay, so what we've seen I've tried to show you from the integer quantum Hall edge and the topological insulator edge, I've tried to show you two different mechanisms for edge protection. So one mechanism is if you have an imbalance between the number of right and left moving modes, you're guaranteed to have a protected edge. And that's exemplified by the integer quantum Hall states. The other mechanism is that sometimes you can have a system that has certain symmetries, and these symmetries basically prohibit all the different ways that you could gap out the edge. So in the presence of these symmetries, again, you can have a protected edge. And the example of that is topological insulators. Okay, so these are two general mechanisms for edge protection. And you can ask a simple question, which is this it? Are there any other mechanisms? Is the story basically over in some sense? Now, another way you can phrase this question is as follows. Instead of saying, are there any other mechanisms, sort of an equivalent question is it possible to have a system which has no symmetry and which has equal numbers of left and right moving modes and still has a protected edge? If such a system existed, it would, by definition, prove that the story isn't complete, right? Because this system is clearly, that this edge mode is clearly not protected by symmetry, because we don't have any symmetry, and it's not protected by this imbalance, this thermal Hall conductance. So such a system would clearly indicate that there's a new mechanism for edge protection that we've missed. Okay, so that's a question. That's sort of the question I want to discuss in this talk. Now, naively, you might think the answer to this question is no. A system with no symmetry and with equal numbers of left and right moving modes can't have a protected edge. I mean, after all, if you have equal numbers of left and right moving modes and you have no symmetry to protect against backscattering, why couldn't you gap out the edge? It doesn't seem like there's any reason why the edge should be protected. And indeed, in non-interacting fermion systems, you can prove, this is indeed the case. In non-interacting fermion systems, you can prove, it was shown, I think, some time ago, it's been known for a long time, that in a non-interacting fermion system without any symmetry and with equal numbers of left and right moving modes, they never have protected edges. But what I want to discuss in this talk is this sort of result that when you consider systems with interactions, the story changes. In particular, sort of surprisingly, it is possible. Yes, it is possible to have this phenomenon of a protected edge mode in the absence of symmetry or chirality. And this physics, this occurs in interacting systems, in fact, strongly interacting systems, more specifically, strongly interacting systems that have that are fractionalized, that have excitations with fractional charge and fractional statistics. Sorry. Actually, not fractional charge, fractional statistics. Yeah.
I have a quick question. When you say no symmetry, so you don't even have charge conservation?
That's right. All symmetry should be broken.
N right log equal NMF is, I mean, you have to have equivalence between the two. I mean, if I have a two-thirds edge, I have two quite different.
Right. So I'm going to get there. You're ahead of the game. Yeah.
When you say no symmetry, do you mean that all symmetries are prohibited, or do you mean that we don't have time-reversal symmetry in charge?
I mean, I want a system where your all symmetries can be broken. So it's an edge, a protected edge, which is stable against any kind of interaction, independent of symmetry. Okay.
Okay,
so surprisingly, the answer to this question is yes. Now let me give you an example of such a system. So the example is the following. I want to imagine the following geometry. I want to imagine a nu equals two-thirds fractional quantum Hall state. Now, nu equals two-thirds fractional quantum Hall state is a simple state. It's the particle hole conjugate of the one-third Laughlin state. So you can think of it as a one-third Laughlin state of holes. And I want to put this nu equals two-thirds fractional quantum Hall state, and I'm going to put it next to a superconductor. Now, why am I putting a superconductor here? It's really sort of for technical reasons. It's because, remember, we're interested in systems without any symmetry. So I want to break all the symmetries in the problem, including charge conservation. And putting a superconductor here allows us to probe the physics of edge mode without any symmetries, including charge conservation. Now, if we look at this system, what are its properties? Well, it's been shown that the nu equals two-thirds edge, at least a simple model for it, has one right moving mode and one left moving mode. So in particular, it has no imbalance between the number of right and left moving modes. Also, if you look at this system, you can see by construction, it has no symmetries. All symmetries have been broken, including charge conservation. So naively, you might think there's no reason why this edge should be protected. With backscattering, we should be able to gap out this edge. But what I'm going to argue today is that this edge is in fact protected. Now to sort of emphasize the kind of what I think is the surprising nature of this result, I want to give you another example to contrast it with. So here I want to imagine something very similar. I want to consider something, the nu equals 8/9 state. Now the nu equals 8/9 state has never been seen experimentally. However, we can still imagine it's a matter of principle. So what is the nu equals 8/9 state? This would be the particle conjugate of the 1/9 Laughlin state, completely analogous to the nu equals 2/3 state, which is the particle conjugate of the 1/3 Laughlin state. So I want to imagine taking the nu equals 8/9 state and putting it adjacent to a superconductor.
What is the charge of the two modes in these cases?
I'm sorry?
What is the charge of the left and right moving modes here?
One's neutral, the other is...
I'm not sure how to answer that question. In any case, we're breaking charge conservation anyway.
Without the superconductor, there's a definite answer, no?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so, but what do you mean? Okay, so the simplest model for the edge you would have, okay, actually not necessarily the simplest, but a model for the edge, you have a right moving mode that carries charge and a left moving mode that would be neutral. That's right. But we're going to break charge conservation symmetry.
But you can't break chiral charge. You can't break the quantum hole.
No, okay, so I'll explain this in a second. But so if we look at the nu equals 8/9 state, again, we have equal numbers of right and left moving modes. And again, we've broken all the symmetries. And so you might think the edge is not protected. And indeed, in this case, I'll show you the edge is not protected. Okay, so these two examples I've chosen because they look very similar to one another. It's hard to see a qualitative difference between these two. So why is it that one gives you a protected edge and the other doesn't give you a protected edge? So what I'm going to argue is the reason has to do with the fractional statistics in the bulk. These two phases have different types of fractional statistics. And I'm going to argue that some types of fractional statistics are intrinsically incompatible with a gapped edge. And therefore, they lead to protected edge modes. And other types of fractional statistics, such as the ones here, are compatible with the gapped edge. And so the edge is not protected. Now, before I get to that result, I first want to just quickly review, a quick review of fractional statistics.
So you're going to also consider bosons?
Very good question. So I'll get to it in a second. The same phenomena occurs for bosons. Okay. I'm choosing fermions because it's a little more familiar, a little closer to experiment.
Yeah.
Okay. Same, actually, in some sense, it's mathematically simpler for both. Okay, so fractional statistics. So some two-dimensional quantum many-body systems have an interesting property. If you look at their excitations, the particle-like excitations, you find these excitations are neither bosons nor fermions. So if you exchange two excitations, you don't get a phase of plus or minus one, you get some other phase. So these particles, they're not bosons, they're not fermions, they're sometimes called anions. Now, there are actually two types of fractional statistics you can have. The simplest type is the one I've described here, where you exchange two particles, you just get a phase factor. A more complicated type is you exchange two particles, and you get the transformation is described by a unitary matrix. Now, the first type is called abelian statistics, and the second is called non-abelian statistics. Here, I'm going to focus entirely on the simplest type of fractional statistics, abelian statistics, where you just get a phase factor. Okay. So now, there's one sort of crucial fact I want to review about abelian statistics, which is the following. Imagine that you did a measurement in the lab, and you're convinced that you have some system that has fractional statistics, and you want to communicate to your friend what exactly the fractional statistics are in your sample. So you want to be able to characterize the state and give them the data they need to know to completely characterize the statistics in your system. So how would you do that? Well, there's two pieces of data you have to give your friend. First piece of data is you have to tell them, given any two particles, given a single particle m, so m here labels the different types of particle excitations, you have to explain for each particle type, what is the exchange statistics? What are the statistics you get if you exchange this particle with itself? And we'll denote that phase by e to the I theta m. The other piece of data you have to give is given any two distinct, or any two particles, they don't have to be the same, they can be different types of particles, you have to give the phase that you get when you move one particle all the way around the other. So this is called mutual statistics, and we'll denote it by e to the I theta lm. And this is the complete set of data. So if you tell someone what are the exchange statistics of every particle in the theory, what are the mutual statistics of every pair of particles, then you've completely told them the structure of abelian statistics in your theory. Okay, so with this sort of review of fractional statistics, now I'm going to state my main result. So the result I want to tell you is that some types of statistics are fundamentally incompatible with a gapped edge. And those types of statistics lead to protected edge modes. Other types of statistics are compatible with a gapped edge. And there's a simple criterion that distinguishes the two. So what is the criterion? So I'm going to give you the criterion as follows. So this criterion is going to be stated as which types of statistics are compatible with a gapped edge. So if you like, these are the statistics which don't lead to protected edges. Okay? It's phrased in slightly opposite to the way I've been working up till now, but it's just easier to work with that language. So what is the criterion? So the statement is a system can have a gapped edge. We're going to consider systems with equal numbers of left and right moving modes, because remember, if you have different numbers of left and right moving modes, you're guaranteed to have a protected edge. So it's kind of a boring case. So a system with equal numbers of left and right moving modes can have a gapped edge if and only if it has a particular type of statistics. So what is that statistics? It has to have the following property. There has to exist a subset of quasiparticles, M, which has two properties. First property is any two particles in M have trivial mutual statistics with respect to each other. So they're mutually bosonic. So all the particles in M have to be mutually bosonic. The second property is that for every particle not in M, there has to exist at least one particle that is in M with which it has non-trivial mutual statistics. Okay? So if such a subset of M exists, then the system can have a gapped edge. If no such subset exists, then it has a protected edge. And
Michael?
Yeah.
I think you said mutual bosonic. It should be said mutual double bosonic because you do a full gradient rather than a single gradient.
Oh, so language. What I mean here by mutually bosonic is if I go all the way around.
Okay, so it's a full gradient.
Okay, yeah.
Could you give us a definition of what you mean by NR and NL? It's not an obvious thing.
Right. So the simplest way to state this is a system with vanishing thermal Hall conductance. Okay. So NR minus NL equals zero.
Yeah, that's different. That's
yeah.
Definition.
I know, but it's language. NR minus NL equals zero.
There's no fundamental definition of NR. And
that's
NR.
Right.
Fundamental difference of various.
This is the difference. That's right. So this set is a special, this kind of set, if it exists, we'll call it Lagrangian subgroup. And the statement is a system has a gapped edge. Can have a gapped edge if and only if it has a Lagrangian subgroup. If no such Lagrangian subgroup exists, it must have a protected edge.
You're gonna tell us that you can gap the edge of the 8-9 state?
That's right. That's right. I'll be getting to that. That's like the next slide. Okay.
Sounds
so, So this is called a Lagrangian subgroup. And so so why is this? So the claim is that these Lagrangian subgroups don't always exist. They can be hard to find. Some systems don't have any Lagrangian subgroup. And why is that? Well, if you look at these two conditions, you can see the first condition here requires all the particles to have trivial statistics with respect to each other. So this condition sort of requires M to not be too big. Can't include too many particles, right? Because they all have to have trivial statistics. The second condition kind of says M can't be too small, because for every particle not in M, there has to be one particle in M with which it has non-trivial statistics. So these two conditions are kind of in conflict with each other. So sometimes you can't find a subset that satisfies both. Yes.
There's no restriction that both the self statistics support truth and M.
You mean exchange statistics?
Yeah.
Well, for the fermionic case, there's no such restriction. For bosonic case, I would add an extra condition, which is that they have to be bosons. In the fermionic case, I don't care because I can explain that, but because this requires that they have to be either bosons or fermions. And then since I'm building out of fermions, I can always attach a fermion. It's sort of a matter of definition. Statistics is somehow defined up to minus sign in some convention. Okay, so let me give you an example. Let's go back to those two examples I gave before. So let's talk about the nu equals 8 ninth state. So the nu equals 8 ninth state has 9 different topologically distinct types of quasiparticles, which you can label by their charge. Simplest is the vacuum or sort of trivial particle. Then you have E over 9 particle, elementary E over 9 particle. You can have a particle which has charge 2E over 9 and go all the way up to 8E over 9. Of course, you could go up to 9E over 9, but that would be an electron, which is topologically trivial. So we count that as the same thing as 0. So there are 9 distinct types of particles. Now the claim is, if you work it out, you can convince yourself that this statistics, there does exist a Lagrangian subgroup, which is given by this following set, 0, 3 over 9, 6e over 9. So you can check that all these particles have trivial statistics with respect to each other, and every particle that's not in this set, like say e over 9, has non-trivial statistics with at least one of them. Okay, so it's indeed a Lagrangian subgroup. So according to the criterion, this edge can be gapped. What about the?
That's an assertion. So.
That's right. I'm gonna get there. Okay. So what about the two-thirds state? So the two-thirds state has 3 distinct types of quasiparticles: 0 e over 3, 2 e over 3. Once you get to 3 e over 3, it's an electron, which I consider to be trivial. So here you can quickly convince yourself there's no Lagrangian subgroup, because remember all the particles in M have to have trivial statistics with respect to themselves, right? And e over 3 and 2 e over 3. Don't have that property. So the only subset M that would satisfy the first condition is the set consisting of 0, just the vacuum. And you can easily see that won't satisfy the second condition. So there's no Lagrangian subgroup. So according to this criterion, the edge in this case is protected. Okay, so these are some examples. Now what I want to do is derive this criterion for you. So I'm going to derive it for you in 2 different ways. First, I'm going to give it to you, derive it using a microscopic argument. And second, I'm going to derive using a more general argument using ideas from Braden statistics. So let's start with the microscopic argument. So let's first just think about these two examples. Let's try to understand why is the nu equals 8 ninth state, why can that edge be gapped, and why is the two-thirds state protected? So let's look at a concrete theory for the nu equals 8 ninth edge. So the nu equals 8 ninth edge has 2 edge modes, at least in the simplest model, which we can label by 2 fields, phi 1 and phi 2. And if you look at a bosonized description of the edge theory, it's given by this action I've written here. The key things you should focus on here are 2 things. One is V1 and V2 describe the velocities of our 2 modes, V1 and 2. And these numbers, there's a minus 9 here, and there's a 1. There's kind of a 1 up here. That's a key structure that we'll come back in a second. Okay, so now, of course, in addition to telling you the Lagrangian, I also have to tell you, to complete the theory, how do you write physical operators in this language? So in particular, I have to tell you how to write electron operators in terms of phi 1 and phi 2. So in this convention, an electron operator on the first edge is written as e to the I phi 1, whereas an electron operator on the second edge in this normalization convention is written as e to the minus 9 I phi 2. Okay, so that's how you write the electron operators. Now, just to sort of make the notation a little simpler, we can rewrite this action in a simpler way. So what we can do is we can combine phi 1 and phi 2 into one field, phi, and then and we can combine our 2 velocities into one velocity matrix, V, And we can combine those two numbers I told you about here, 1 and minus 9, into one 2 by 2 matrix K. And then our whole theory can be written in this relatively simple notation. OK, so that's the edge theory. Now let's try to understand whether it can be gapped out or not. So what's the simplest way we could gap out the edge? So the simplest way we can imagine gapping out the edge is to add some kind of scattering term, which backscatters a right moving electron into right moving electrons into left moving electrons. So the most general scattering term you could write down of that type is something of the form psi 1 to the p, psi 2 to the q plus Hermitian conjugate, which if you write in terms of phi 1 and phi 2 fields, it would have this kind of cosine-like term. Now, important point here is that I'm not going to require that p plus q equals 0. That is, I'm not going to require that these terms conserve charge. And why is that? Because remember, I'm putting a superconductor on the edge, so charge is not conserved. However, I am going to require that p plus q is even. I'm going to require that fermion, while charge isn't conserved, I certainly am going to require that fermion parity is conserved. So I'm going to allow any such term, I'm going to consider any such term that conserves fermion parity. Now, that is, such that p plus q is even. So the question is, do these terms gap the edge? So let's pick a particular term. Does this particular term gap the edge? OK, so let's answer that question. So it turns out there's a very simple criterion for when such a term, a cosine term, will gap the edge, at least in the limit of large u. This criterion is due to Haldane. And it's a simple criterion. It's called a null vector criterion. And the statement is that that cosine term can gap the edge if and only if this PQ is a null vector for this matrix, this K matrix, 1 minus 9. So in other words, PQ times the matrix times PQ equals 0. Now, where does this criterion come from? Well, I can just give you a quick answer. So where this comes from is the following. It turns out that if P and Q satisfy this algebraic equation, then it guarantees that you can make a change of variables to some new quantities. We'll call them theta and phi. There's some combinations of phi 1 and phi 2, such that in the new variables, the Lagrangian is very simple. It's what I've written here. So what is this new Lagrangian? Well, if you look at this for a second, this is exactly a sine Gordon model. It's just a non-chiral Luttinger liquid with a backscattering term, or a sine Gordon model, whichever language you prefer. And we know that in a sine Gordon model or in a Luttinger liquid, if this cosine term, if the coefficient is sufficiently large, we can gap out the edge because what will happen is the phase will get locked to the minimums of the cosine, and the edge will become gapped out. OK, so this is the criterion for whether it can gap out the edge. Now let's try to test it for the 8/9 case. So we need to solve this equation. So if you look at it, it's just a simple equation, p squared minus 9q squared equals 0. And you can see by inspection, you can find a solution. Solution is p equals 3, q equals, say, minus 1. So what do we learn here? So we can gap out the edge. Now, importantly, this term, you can see, this term that we're adding, this cosine term, which I've written here, does not conserve electric charge. In fact, it scatters 3 electrons from one mode to 1 electron from the other mode. However, it does conserve electric charge modulo 2. So it's perfectly allowed in the presence of this superconductor adjacent to the edge. OK, so what have we shown? The 8/9 edge can be gapped out, and we have an explicit perturbation that does the job. Now let's repeat this for the 2/3 case. So for the 2/3 case, if you repeat the same analysis, you get this very similar equation. But now, instead of 1 and minus 9, you have 1 and minus 3. So we look at this equation. It becomes p squared minus 3q squared equals 0. And you can see, by inspection, this does not have any integer solutions because square root of 3 is an irrational number, unlike square root of 9. So what does this mean? This means that at least the simple scattering terms we've discussed here, the simple cosine terms we've discussed here, cannot gap the edge of the 2/3 state, which suggests that it's protected. OK, so those are two examples. Now I just want to quickly tell you how you could generalize this to more general abelian states. So in the general case, we're going to imagine a state which has n right-moving modes and n left-moving modes, so a total of 2n modes. And to gap out the edge in this case, the simplest way of doing that would be to add n backscattering terms, because each backscattering term gaps out a single pair of modes. So we're going to And you can easily generalize that null vector criterion I gave you before. And the generalization is very simple. So So these backscattering terms, which are parameterized by these n integer vectors, will gap out the edge if and only if the lambda i's k lambda j equals 0 for all I and j. So this is they all are mutually null. Okay, so if you believe this analysis, we have a simple condition for when the edge can be gapped out. It's whether or not we can solve this Diophantine equation. Okay, now it's not obvious. However, you can show mathematically, a purely mathematical result, that this equation has a solution if and only if there exists a Lagrangian subgroup M. What does that mean? That if you believe this analysis, that means that a system with a Lagrangian subgroup, this shows explicitly that we can gap out the edge, and a system that does not have a Lagrangian subgroup, it shows that at least for the simplest types of terms, we cannot gap out the edge. Okay, so that's the first derivation of this criterion, but you know, you may not like this derivation, and you have good reason to complain. So there are a couple problems with it. So one problem is that we only consider the simplest types of backscattering terms, these very simple cosine terms. So there are many other terms you could add in principle. So we proved that the two-thirds edge was stable against these terms, but there are an infinite number of other terms out there that we didn't check. So we haven't really shown the edge is protected. We've only given evidence that's protected. On the other hand, we did show that the 8/9 edge is gappable. We showed that explicitly, but we haven't proven that the two-thirds edge is truly protected. So that means we've only proven that the condition that I gave you is sufficient for having a gapped edge. We haven't proven that it's necessary. Okay, so that's one complaint. The other complaint is that the physical interpretation of what I've told you is completely unclear, right? I haven't explained at all what does this have to do with statistics in the bulk, right? The connection with statistics in the bulk came from some mathematical theorem, which I didn't even tell you about, which connects solutions to some equation to statistics. Okay, so it's completely obscure what the physical interpretation is. Okay, so what I want to do now in the second, the remainder of the talk is give you another derivation of this criterion, which will address these two issues. So this criterion will explain the physical interpretation and the connection with fractional statistics, and it will prove that the criterion is necessary for having a gapped edge, which was the missing component from this proof. It won't prove it's sufficient. We've already proven it's sufficient, but it will prove it's necessary. So we'll be able to prove things like the two-thirds edge is indeed protected. So how does this other argument work? So the idea is the following. It's based on the basic idea is the following. What we're going to do is we're going to assume the system has a gapped edge, okay? And then we're going to prove, just by self-consistency arguments, that it must satisfy the criterion. That is, there must be at least one Lagrangian subgroup. So how does the argument work? So the argument is based on a concept of annihilating particles at an edge, quasi-particles at an edge. So the idea is the following. Let's think of the following thought experiment. Let's imagine creating a particle and antiparticle out of the bulk, nucleating them out of the ground state, and then bringing them near the edge. Once we do that, we can distinguish between two logical possibilities. One possibility is that we can construct local operators localized near these two particles, and such that when we apply those local operators to this state, we annihilate the particles and return the system to the ground state. So we can find some local operators acting near M and M bar, and when we apply those local operators, we can just annihilate them. Okay, so that's one possibility. If that's the case, then we'll say that these particles can be annihilated at the edge. Okay, the other possibility is that no matter how hard we try, you know, we're over here, no matter how hard we try, no local operator we find can annihilate the particles. The particles carry some kind of non-trivial topological charge, and we just can't get rid of them. Okay, so that's the second possibility. And in that case, we'll say these particles can't be annihilated at the edge. Okay, so now here's the key idea of the proof. Let's consider the set of all particles that can be annihilated at the edge. Okay, we'll call that M. I'm going to prove for you that this set has to be a Lagrangian subgroup. It has to satisfy those two conditions I gave you before. So that will imply any system with a gapped edge must have at least one Lagrangian subgroup. Therefore, systems that will prove that this criterion is at least necessary for having a gapped edge. We already proved it was sufficient. Okay, so how is this argument going to work? So I need to show that M satisfies those two conditions that I gave you earlier. So we'll start with condition one. So I want to show that M satisfies condition one of the criterion. So how are we going to do that? So the idea is the following. Let's imagine this, a three-step process where we create two particles in the bulk, bring them to the edge, and then annihilate them. Okay? Now we can imagine constructing an operator, W sub m, which implements this process. And this W sub m, intuitively, it's going to have a sort of string-like structure where we drag the particles to the two edges, and then it'll have some stuff at the ends where we're annihilating the particles. Okay, so we can define such operators, which create and annihilate the particles. Now, by construction, if we apply this operator to the ground state, we get the ground state back again, because we, at the end of the process, we've annihilated the particles. Okay? So now what I want to do is imagine applying this process twice. So first, I'm going to do it with some particle m, and then I'm going to do it with some particle m prime, two separate curves, okay? Now, since each one of these operators takes the ground state to the ground state, if I apply them in succession, I will also get the ground state, okay? Now what I want to imagine doing is we could do the same thing, but in the opposite order. Here we apply W sub m first, and then W sub m prime. But we could do in the opposite order, and first apply W sub m prime, and then W sub m. But by the same reasoning, that will also take our ground state to our ground state, since each of these individually take us from our ground state to our ground state. So in particular, what do we conclude? We conclude that the two orderings, applying m prime and then m, or applying m and then m prime, they have to give you the same state, namely the ground state. OK, now to complete the argument, what I want to argue is that these two operators have to satisfy an interesting commutation algebra. And we're going to compare that commutation algebra to this equation and derive some consequences. So what is that commutation algebra? So the claim is that if you take any two string operators, we can forget the edge. Just consider string operators defined in the bulk, that they have a commutation algebra where if I apply one string followed by the other, or I compare it to doing it in the opposite order, I get a phase factor. Oh, this shouldn't be a 2. I'm sorry. There shouldn't be a 2 here. I get a phase factor. This is a typo, which is exactly the mutual statistics of the two particles. So how can you prove that statement? Well, one way is to think about these processes, which I've shown here. Let's think about physically the physical meaning of these two processes. So in this process, we create two blue particles, and then we can imagine here creating a pair of red particles, braiding one all the way around, and then annihilating it. Here, we do the same thing, but we first create two red particles and braid them around, and then we create two blue particles. Well, you can convince yourself that in one process, that these two processes should differ by a phase factor, which is exactly the mutual statistics. There shouldn't be a 2 here. Why is that? Because in this case, we're braiding a red particle all the way around a blue particle. The blue particle was already there. In this case, we move the red particle around. There's nothing there. The blue particles come later. So this should exactly have an extra phase. Maybe I have them backwards, which is the mutual statistics. Okay, so. So there's a general principle, which is that these operators don't commute. Their commutation algebra is given by the mutual statistics without this 2. So putting that all together with our construction here, we can see that if we apply these two operations in the opposite orders, m and m prime or m prime and m, the difference, there should be a phase factor, which is exactly their mutual statistics. Okay, so now we look at this equation and we compare with our previous derivation, which said that the two orderings gave you the same thing without any phase factor. So if we compare those two, we can conclude that this phase factor must equal 1. That is, every two pair of particles in M, they must have trivial mutual statistics with respect to each other. And that proves the first condition. It proves M satisfies the first condition for Lagrangian subgroup. All particles are mutually bosonic with each other. OK, now what I want to do next is just to finish is I want to tell you, I want to derive for you the second condition for a Lagrangian subgroup. So the second condition for a Lagrangian subgroup comes from a very deep property about systems with fractional statistics called braiding non-degeneracy. So what is braiding non-degeneracy? Well, let's forget the edge. Let's go deep within the bulk. Braiding non-degeneracy is the following statement. Imagine I have some particle L. And imagine that this particle has the property that no matter what local operator I apply, I cannot annihilate this particle, cannot be annihilated in the bulk. Okay? Braiding non-degeneracy is the statement that if it can't be annihilated in the bulk, there must exist at least one other particle that has non-trivial statistics with respect to it. So if L can't be annihilated in the bulk, there exists a particle M which has non-trivial statistics. And the intuition behind this is very simple. If a particle can't be annihilated in the bulk, then that means that there must that I can't be annihilated even by cutting a big hole around it. That's a local operation. So that means that there's some signature of L arbitrarily far away. That means you should be able to measure the presence of L by some operation arbitrarily far away. Now, intuitively, the only way you can measure the presence of a particle arbitrarily far away in a gap system is by interferometry. So that means there must exist some other particle M which has non-trivial statistics. That's the only way we could measure its presence. Now, if you believe Brady non-degeneracy in the bulk, you should also believe that you could also believe that there's the same kind of phenomenon at the edge. So imagine that I have a particle which can't be annihilated locally at the edge. So my claim is by the same reasoning, that means that if I cut a hole around this particle, there must be some signature of the particle arbitrarily far away. And if there's some signature arbitrarily far away, there must be some way to measure its presence. And that means that intuitively, such a measurement would require some kind of, would be based on some kind of braiding measurement. Now, the analog of braiding at the edge is a process where I create two particles in the bulk, bring them to the edge, and annihilate them. It's kind of like a half of a braiding. So by this reasoning, we conclude that if L can't be annihilated at the edge, there must exist an M which can be annihilated at the edge and which has non-trivial statistics with respect to L. Because otherwise, we wouldn't be able to measure its presence. It's just like braiding non-degeneracy in the bulk. And this condition is exactly condition two. It says that M satisfies condition two, and so it proves that M is indeed a Lagrangian subgroup. Now, I should say that this argument I've given you for braiding non-degeneracy is just some intuition. If you're interested in a more rigorous argument, that's in my paper, and I can also discuss that with you afterwards. So I just want to conclude here. So I've tried to tell you three different things. First, I've tried to show you that systems with equal numbers of left and right moving modes and no symmetry can still have protected edges, even though you wouldn't expect it. And this edge protection originates from a completely different mechanism from that you're familiar with. It has nothing to do with Hall conductance or any kind of transport property. It comes from the structure of fractional statistics in the bulk. Sometimes the fractional statistics are compatible with a gapped edge, and some are fundamentally incompatible and lead to edge protection. And finally, I've derived a general criterion for when a system has a protected edge, that is, what types of statistics can lead to a protected edge and which ones don't lead to a protected edge. Thanks for your attention.
Hey, Michael, so I don't follow why you can justify. You have these two operators, blue one and the red one. You draw like this, they are linked to each other. I would draw them just like this, then you don't have an argument. So how do you argue that they have to be like this?
But they don't have to be, but to come up with the contradiction, you consider that particular process like this.
Is there something about time, you know, how I just don't understand basically how do you do this?
So that's not, yeah, so this is a, so it's a thought experiment. So we imagine that particular process, and by imagining that process, we obtain some constraints by thinking about this process. It's true, you could imagine other processes that would give you no constraints, but this process gives you a constraint on statistics.
So in the case of this gap edge conditions, in the case that you consider focus on abelian topological order by Kinnick transcendent theory,
yeah.
So the work I done with Xiaogang is some condition like this determined K of the K matrix needs to be some kind of squareable. So is there conditions you have?
No, so that condition is implied. So it's not sufficient, but it's necessary. In other words, that's part of the reason I had to go to 1/9. So to have a Lagrangian subgroup, you can show that Lagrangian subgroup always has a size which is square root of the number of particles. So in particular, the number of particles has to be perfect square for an abelian state. That's right.
So maybe I just didn't get in the last slide. You have the spin particle which detects the L particle.
Yeah.
And then you move to the boundary. But how do you know you can generate M at the boundary?
Generate M.
Well, I mean, you have to get a single M particle from the boundary.
No, so, okay, so first of all, yeah. So first of all, I should say that this argument that I'm giving here really is just the intuition. So I think it's not a rigorous proof, but the idea is to just use the same philosophy. So, and the rigorous proof is based on this intuition, right? So the idea is that if you can't annihilate a particle in the bulk, you must be able to measure it, and we expect measuring is based on braiding or Aronoff bone. So we do the same thing at the edge. right? So if you can't annihilate this at the edge, you must be able to measure it. Now the analog at the edge is to take two particles, let's create them in the bulk, just for simplicity, and bring them to the edge and then annihilate them.
How do you know
that? That's the claim, that's the point, is that if you could, that's the only way we could measure its presence. That's the analog of braiding. So if you could annihilate them, and this would be kind of exactly analogous to braiding, it's like a half braid. You create the two particles, you bring them to the edge, you annihilate them, you measure the Berry phase, and you can detect the existence of the particle. If you can't annihilate them at the edge, there's no Berry phase you can detect. It's not it wouldn't give you a way to measure the presence of this particle.
Oh, you're saying you could measure its presence at the bulk, but then not at the boundary.
That's right. And the particles that can be annihilated at the boundary in particular obey that. You can't measure their presence non-locally.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what do we know about the non-abelian theories in the past?
You mean the similar criterion for non-abelian theories? So that's an open question, I haven't worked on that. Some of the arguments generalize. So, and also there's another argument I didn't give you based on modular invariance that you can do equally well for non-abelian cases. But I would say that I don't have both arguments. Here we prove both ways. We are able to prove the criterion was both necessary and sufficient. For non-abelian, you can prove certain things are necessary, but proving they're sufficient requires more work.
Okay, I guess my comment on this, I mean, the two edges you look at, they have no thermal Hall effect.
That's right.
So the issue is whether you can, what happens when you put a superconductor onto the boundary of a quantum Hall state with no thermal Hall effect. But of course, you're not really abolishing an edge because there's a gapless, the superconductor is gapless, and of course you really just... All that's happened is that the superconductor is kind of being incorporated into the edge. I mean, certainly, there's got to be an edge current that flows around the thing. It just flows through the superconductor now. It's still, there's a charge gap. The superconductor has a zero, has no gap for charge. It's stationary, but accepts. It's a condensator charge 2. So what's the difference between the 2/3 and the 8/9? One case you could have a charge 2 boson, the other case you couldn't?
I don't think charge plays an important role in this difference. So. If that issue is bothering you.
Whether the Hall current can flow into the superconductor or not is the issue. Something has to, the Hall current is flowing to the edge, there's a chiral anomaly at the edge. It's got to go somewhere. But usually, if there's a vacuum on the other side, the gapless edge might be accepted. If you're putting a system that can accept charge on the other side, so there's. The only difference is the superconductor between the charging units of 2.
Yeah, I don't think it's the charge that's the issue. But I mean, you're raising points which I haven't thought about.
What's completely unsurprising is that you can have protected edge states. The opposite is surprising.
I think different people find different things surprising.
But it's kind of
surprising.
If you're putting quantum Hall, it's absolutely clear. Because they're incompatible. The surprising thing is you're saying you can put a superconductor.
Well, so
states and not others that will...
I think, like I said, it depends on your point of view. So from some points of view, we know many, many states which can be gapped out, topological states can be gapped out. The Torr code is an example. We know other examples.
The trouble is it's not really gapped out because there's a gapless edge.
No, not the Torr code.
The superconductor is a gapless edge.
So which point of view you find surprising is different. For me, what's surprising is that there exists a protected edge mode that comes from statistics. So that's what I've emphasized here.
Okay. So now we've got Brad Swindle.